Professor Taira has been at Stanford, I think, for the past 3 years. Before that, he was in the economics division of the International Labor Organization in Geneva, where I met him. Prior to that time, he had taught at the University of Washington and the University of the Ryukyus, and he has his PhD at the University of Stanford, where he is now teaching. Professor Taira has written a great deal on wages, wage structures in both developing and developed countries, and more recently, in tune with the times, he has started to do some work on poverty efforts, which we are all acquainted with in the United States, but speaking for myself, I think, and perhaps for some others, we are not so well acquainted with the poverty efforts, with the anti-poverty efforts, rather, in other countries. And therefore, he is going to speak to us this afternoon, and this, I believe, is the same talk that he will also be giving at the Midwest Economic Meetings, for those of you who will go and can perhaps then go to another meeting. He's going to talk this afternoon on anti-poverty efforts in rich and poor countries. It's a great pleasure to introduce Mr. Taira.
Thank you, Jack. I feel enormously comfortable to be with you and with a few more familiar faces. And this comfortable feeling is based on the satisfactory work relations we enjoyed in the foreign country, which was foreign to both of us. I'm a little ashamed of trying to venture into a field which came into purview only recently. But since it is the function of the intellectual to keep abreast of the march of events, discussing subject matters in the light of insufficient evidence to keep public policy rolling in the right nature, I, with disclaimer of my basic incompetence, will nevertheless try to say a few words in regard to the great issue that that is of overriding importance to us all. Poverty is evidently a great problem, and with the size of the problem, one can also say poverty and anti-poverty efforts can be a great industry. The big money involved in all this is not, unfortunately, produced by additional output, and this adds to the magnitude of the problem. Money involved in large part must come from the pockets of one set of people to be given into the pockets of another set of people. The latter people who receive the money transferred from the general public are the poor. My concern in this paper is about the nature and extent of poverty as evidenced by social assistance measures in various countries. As you well know, the title and mechanism of social assistance vary from country to country. But the essence of social assistance is income transfer from the general society to the poor. The unfortunate thing about social assistance is that it is not justified in terms of prior contributions by the recipients toward the resources from which the transfer is made. This unfortunate aspect of social assistance is therefore accompanied by uneasy, unsettled questions. Since all of the poor are not the beneficiaries of social assistance, just where the line should be drawn between eligible and non-eligible poor. is a thorny question. Why do the poor have special claims to a share in the social product? This is another question. And the basic to all questions that one may like to raise in regard to social assistance is the basic question, who are the poor in the first place? Different societies have answered these questions differently. The diversity of anti-poverty efforts added to the diversity of countries and the multiplicity of answers to many of these questions I have mentioned can be enormously frustrating for their lack of systematic features. But it is precisely in regard to the diversity of the systems and the practices that we find intellectual challenge in these problems. To put it simply, the socioeconomic context within which the issue of social assistance arises is nothing but the total socioeconomic system itself. A segment of the population considered poor by public consensus emerges from normal socioeconomic processes. Among the poor are those who clearly lack the means or capacity to support themselves, such as the old, the young, the sick, the disabled, the handicapped, and the mentally disturbed, since it can be supposed that there is always a sufficient supply of humanitarian concern about the lot of these social dependents, society's ability to attend to their needs is essentially limited by the availability of resources, which in most cases depends upon the level of economic development. After the most obvious cases of poverty are taken care of, there still remain those who are poor by the community standard of living. What should or can be done to help them is the question that has generated endless controversies in many countries. The assistance schemes and the criteria for eligibility in various countries today represent a variety of solutions for this issue. In this paper from which I'm delivering my verbal observations consists of three sections. First, we offer theoretical considerations on the place and the meaning of poverty in the modern society as a frame of reference for a systematic understanding of the poor as a social category. Next, we undertake international comparisons of the standard of living up to which social assistance purports to raise the incomes of the poor, noting at the same time how widely the nature and scope of social assistance vary from country to country. Finally, we examine how much poverty still remains unattended in various countries with respect to the income level officially recognized as a poverty line. The first section of the paper has been a product of my agonizing thought processes. In this section, I have endeavored to stretch analytical and theoretical imagination available to the economist beyond the regular confines of economic analysis and theory to account for poverty as a social problem. The basic and innocuous characteristic of poverty is, of course, the low level of income, markedly below the level of income of the general society. Far more serious, though less visible, are certain other aspects of poverty. Because of their low incomes, as Professor Galbraith points out, the poor cannot have what the larger community regards as the minimum necessary for decency, and they cannot wholly escape the judgment of the larger community that they are indecent. They are degraded because, in the literal sense, they live outside the grades or categories which the community regards as acceptable. Intuitively, it seems that in the modern civil society, with developed economy and egalitarian ideals, incomes, whatever their levels may be, could still bring about an honorable level of living. However, the extraordinary fact is that a modern society denies honor to the poor and regards it proper for them to suffer from degradation and alienation. Why is it that life is so harsh for the poor in the modern society? Is there anything in the economic behavior of modern man that leads to this social and moral peculiarity in an affluent society? Economically speaking, the standard of living is nothing but the collection of goods and services consumed. In the conventional theory of consumer behavior, a higher standard of living is preferred to a lower because more goods and services consumed yield greater utility. It is obvious that this theory leaves out aspirations for decency and respectability as the ingredients of the drive toward higher living standards. What is to be explained is why a collection of goods and services consumed below a certain level plunges the consumer into a social category called poor, with privileges, if any, and disadvantages appropriate to this category. But there is no need for the economic theory of consumer behavior, if properly formulated, to be as powerless as its strictly conventional version in the face of challenge of poverty. Indeed, a proper theory already exists in the kit of tools for economic analysis. It is a theory of consumer behavior proposed by Professor Duesenberry, by which it is possible to deduce the social nature of poverty as a product of the free play of consumer preferences. According to Duesenberry, the utility of consumption depends not only on the range and the quantities of goods and services consumed, but also on their qualities, which can be rated on the scale of superiority, inferiority. But the quality of a good or a service is a complex concept which is difficult to define with any degree of precision for practical application. Social consensus is the sole authority which can impart meanings to quality so that the individual consumer looks toward the general public for signs of fashion and arranges his consumption pattern to the best of his judgment. The essential vagueness of social consensus and probable errors in this judgment render the average consumer uncertain and insecure with respect to the quality index of his consumption pattern. It is therefore natural for the average consumer to try to minimize risks of incorrect choices by making decisions on the basis of most visible and demonstrable components of the standard of living on which there exist fairly certain degrees of consensus. In other words, the consumer is guided by the demonstration effect. The components of lifestyle which are most susceptible to the demonstration effect include houses, cars, dresses, furniture, and the people one associates with. As for the quality of residence, for example, the prestige rating of residential areas is a widely shared piece of information. Under the circumstance, the free play of consumer preferences in search for quality housing stimulates residential mobility and brings about segregation. Thus, the poor tend to be carefully marked by their geographical locations and with their visibly inferior standard of living, evoke fear, suspicion, and contempt on the part of the general public. This is the story about the consequences of free play of consumer preferences. How do the producers in this kind of socioeconomic system behave? The consumer preferences dominated by search for superior life have far-reaching consequences. Since the consumer is a sovereign who reigns if he does not rule, his quality consciousness is taken advantage of by the producer who finds profitable opportunities in product differentiation and non-price competition. This is, of course, a standard story in the theory of monopolistic competition. What is less well known, but no less significant, is that the demonstration effect is, after all, a cast of mind, which applies to practically every social being, regardless of his role or position in the matrix of production, distribution, and consumption. Thus, the quality consciousness of the firm extends from how and what it produces to whom it hires. Just as the consumer desires superior goods, the firm desires superior employees, who, in addition to the standard efficiency required on the job, have certain other desirable and pleasing attributes. These employee qualities are widely recognized components of the hiring standards in many firms. They have been introduced into the labor market theory by distinguished economists like professors Reeder, Lester, and Becker, to mention but a few. Employee qualities, in addition to the basic ability and efficiency appropriate to given jobs in a strictly technical sense, include formal education, connections and references, police records, and personal attributes, which are often as frivolous as physical appearance, comportment, accent, and skin color. The hiring standards of this nature tend to keep the poor out of employment because they are more likely to be deficient in desirable qualities, even if they are capable of competent performance on the appropriate jobs. Add to the difficulties created by consumers and the producers, difficulties created by public regulations. For example, public regulations of conditions of work and employment reinforce the quality consciousness of the firm with respect to technology and workforce. The minimum wages, maximum hours, restrictions on child labor, standards of safety and sanitation, wage-related social security contributions required of the firm, and many other statutory standards define the social minimum standard of business behavior for decency and respectability. There are, of course, some fugitive firms which survive by sub-minimum wages and substandard working conditions, either because laws do not cover their activities or because law enforcement on them is difficult and costly. These firms, while giving jobs to some of the poor who are left out of employment in the respectable sector, actually intensify the differentiation between poor and non-poor by adding elements of delinquency and illegitimacy to the work and the earnings of the poor. Furthermore, in the respectable sector, trade unions strive to widen differentials of amenities over the statutory standards, intensifying in this way the gap between poor and non-poor. Labor legislation and trade union movement, both of which have always been for the poor, so far as their pronounced ideals are concerned, have rather tended to isolate and give a legal status to the poor. Yet the poor, despite a collective and official recognition as a status by the larger community, remain largely disorganized among themselves. The above observation suggests that the poor as a social category arise from, first, the consumer preferences guided by the demonstration effect. Secondly, the producer behavior characterized by dynamic technology and rising hiring standards. And thirdly, the combination of organization and interventions like statutory regulations of the conditions of work and employment and collective bargaining by the organized labor. The poor are those who are left behind in the ghettos or islands of poverty after the departure of those who can afford to move. The poor are those who do not have the skills and the qualities desired by the fanciful employers or required by changing technology. The poor are those who, unemployed or unemployable in the respectable sector, eke out a living through substandard or illegitimate activities with respect to the statutory standards of decent business behavior. The poor are therefore branded with the stigma of failure, indecency, and delinquency. This completes the rough sketch of my theory of poverty as a social category. Of course, this theory does not exhaust all the necessary, logically necessary elements for a more complete explanation of poverty. Its purpose is only to identify the factors which tend to isolate the poor as a social category from the general public. Naturally, these factors are expected to vary in scope and intensity from country to country. It is impossible to compare directly the working of these factors across various countries, but should we find observable differences in the attitudes and policies of the public toward the poor, we may well suppose that these differences can be traced indirectly to the constellation of socioeconomic factors which I have discussed in this section. Armed with this loose socioeconomic theory of poverty, I would now like to discuss how people set the standards of income for the purpose of helping the poor. Since the poor as a social category are products of ordinary socioeconomic processes, it requires an extraordinary determination of society to help the poor with a massive transfer of income. The existence of poverty is a visible proof of how far up the non-poor have climbed the social ladders, so that the ordinary desire of the non-poor would be to leave the poor where they are. No doubt, the meanings of the poor and the non-poor to each other vary from country to country. As for the situation in the United States, one illuminating observation on this point can be quoted. It says as follows: the middle class is defined largely by the fact that the poor exist. If the present poor should become middle class, no meaning should remain to that phrase. Either it would be a euphemism for the lower part of a bipartite division, or it would cease to apply to those who now boast of their middle status. The middle class knows that the economists are right when they say that poverty can be eliminated if we only will it. They simply do not will it. End of quotes. Nevertheless, even in this country, welfare assistance is extended to some of the poor, other than the non-controversial cases of social dependency, like the aged, the young, the sick, and the physically or mentally handicapped. As may be expected, the popular sentiments toward this part of welfare assistance range all the way from an outright disapproval to a guilty conscience about not doing enough for the poor. One indicator of how well society cares for the poor is the level of income below which society is responsible for or helping the substandard income recipients. To say the same thing the other way around, it is the income to which social assistance purports to raise the actual incomes of the poor. This income level is possibly the lowest conceivable as a social minimum standard of living. I call it poverty norm in this paper to eliminate the semantic difficulties that are likely to arise from a variety of official or common titles given to what is essentially the same in different guise. However, income maintenance through social assistance is not a simple affair. It is not true that anyone whose income happens to be below the assistance standard is automatically eligible for assistance. Assistance is given to some and denied to others, while all of them, by the test of income alone, would have been eligible for assistance. The poverty norm is not by itself a complete indicator of how generous society is toward the poor. The norm may be high, but the tight eligibility conditions can squeeze many of the poor out of assistance. The norm may be low, but the eligibility criteria can be generous so as to entitle a large number of poor to benefits. Data on assistance standards are difficult to collect. These data are often kept within the confines of internal documents of welfare agencies. There is also a great variety of languages in the world than one researcher can handle. In addition, welfare schemes are diverse and differentiated for reasons which are often too complicated to unravel. The international comparison of assistance standards would have been enormously simplified if social assistance in all the countries had been centralized and administered to anyone in need by a simple income test, irrespective of the causes of poverty or the personal characteristics of the poor. This type of assistance would be the most enlightened kind. Similarly, the least enlightened type of social assistance would be a local relief granted only to some carefully defined categories of deserving poor. Indeed, it seems possible to place various countries at different evolutionary points on the scale of enlightenment from local relief to national assistance. An intermediate stage may be characterized as the stage of national categorical assistance coupled with locally administered general assistance. To demonstrate the usefulness of this enlightenment scale in regard to social assistance, the United Kingdom is perhaps the most enlightened country with regard to social assistance in the sense of the word mentioned above. In the letter of the law, public assistance in Japan is highly enlightened too. One might even say that it is as enlightened as in the United Kingdom. But the crucial difference between Japan and the United Kingdom is that social insurances and public services in Japan are terribly primitive, and that bad luck, unemployment, industrial accident, sickness, and family size more easily lead to poverty in Japan than in the United Kingdom. The war on poverty in the United States may well be a substitute for national general assistance, although its success in eliminating poverty below the official poverty line adopted for the purpose remains to be seen. So far as social assistance proper is concerned, the United States is in the intermediate stage of development, that is, decentralized categorical assistance with partial subsidies from the federal government. Canada, another federal state, launched in 1965 a scheme called Canada Assistance Plan, which brought Canada closer to the highest stage of social assistance development. It is true that the Canadian Assistance Plan achieves only a halfway nationalization of categorical assistance by making the federal government responsible for sharing the cost of assistance with the provinces on a 50-50 basis. But one of the categorical schemes in the plan has an extraordinary semantic and philosophical versatility. At the federal level, this is called unemployment assistance. It is stipulated that general assistance in the province can be reimbursed by the federal government under the category of unemployment assistance. Unemployment for the purpose is quite generously defined and refers to a situation where a person is currently not engaged in gainful work. No prying questions are asked about reasons for not doing work. Need is the sole criterion for whether or not a person is entitled to unemployment assistance. Thus, Canada's unemployment assistance, while appearing like a categorical assistance, is really a highly enlightened scheme of general assistance. Social development toward enlightenment with respect to poverty is full of colorful events and rhetorics. Public sentiments about poverty and their political consequences are especially volatile in the United States today. The upsurge of democratic compassion toward the poor during the early 1960s had spent itself by the middle of the decade. In 1967, social critics began to see the swelling waves of a middle-class revolution against the poor. In other countries, however, the central tendencies of public sentiments about the poor seem to be rather stable. The able-bodied poor are poor because their rates of pay are low, or because they are unemployed, or are not working enough, While the first reaction that the able-bodied poor elicit in this country, even on the part of some competent economists, is a suspicion about the possible relationship between poverty and leisure, the first reaction in other countries is to ask to what extent society at large shares the blame for the poverty of the able-bodied poor by failing to provide jobs that are good enough to bring about at least a minimum standard of living. Vigorous full employment and rational labor market policies seem to be logical prerequisites for any attempt to assess the relationship among poverty, indolence, and assistance. These policies are likely to be associated with high assistance standards because, with the number of the able-bodied poor reduced to a minimum, the public can now render generous help to that small number of persons who are in real trouble. In the long run, therefore, a full employment economy can afford to make general assistance available both at high standards relative to its economic resources and on the basis of need without fearing that such an assistance scheme might strain the public purse beyond its capacity. In several European countries, various forms of allowance or subsidy are used to supplement social insurance benefits, where the latter fall short of officially recognized minimum cost of living. These cost of living are poverty norms for the purpose of this paper. The supplementary payments to bring individual incomes to their levels are not essentially different from general assistance payments in that they are means tested and financed out of the general revenue without requiring prior contributions from the recipients. But the psychological advantage of supplementary payments is great. They serve the purpose of upholding the personal pride and the dignity of the recipient better than the traditional scheme of social assistance. The poverty norms I have collected are general assistance standards wherever data on them are available. For a few countries, the level of income, for reasons explained previously, brought about by the combination of the basic social security benefits and supplementary assistance is used as a poverty norm. Table 1 in the circulated batch of paper puts together poverty norms as percentages of gross domestic products, and chart 1 shows only those countries selected from table 1 on the basis of greater comparability. In computing the relationship between the poverty norm and the gross domestic product, I have tried, wherever possible, to eliminate rent from the cost of living used as the poverty norm. This is based on several considerations regarding rent. In many countries, rent is officially controlled and housing policy exhibits a good deal of diversity which nullifies the usefulness of rent as as an element in the cost of living that can be subjected to uniform analytical treatment. Even in countries where rents are left to the market for determination, the efficiency of the market itself is suspect. For these and other reasons, I have excluded rent wherever possible from the poverty norm. Data on chart 1, for example, are all net of rent, except for Ireland, Singapore, and Ceylon, for which the sources are silent about the treatment of rent. But fortunately, for these countries, inclusion or exclusion of rent probably would not matter too much in regard to the outcome. Please take a look at chart 1. Contemplation of table 1 would be cumbersome. I'll skip this for the benefit of your private contemplation. chart one at least shows some interesting pattern. The relationship between the poverty norm and gross domestic product per capita is positive up to a middle range of development, and negative among the better developed and more affluent countries. The United States is naturally the most affluent country, and the level of income that social assistance tries to guarantee to the poor relative to the US's national income per capita is not particularly high. The relative poverty norm is, so far as chart one is concerned, lowest on the whole for the US among the countries shown on the same chart. The United Kingdom and Japan do very well. The excellent appearance of Japan's position on this chart creates some conceptual difficulties. Japan certainly is not as affluent as the other countries, but seems to have adopted a relatively high assistance standard for the purpose of administering, public assistance. France and Switzerland on chart one present a different kind of contrast. France's relatively low poverty norm is surprising because one had expected this type of poverty norm, which comes from assistance to the aged, to be extremely favorable in a country like France, where social security is extensively developed and full employment prevails. Perhaps it is in the nature of social insurances, which are the mainstay of France's social security development, to neglect the poor who had failed to contribute to the schemes or had never come into the purview of protection covered by these schemes. Taking Japan and Ireland as countries representative of the middle level of economic development, and drawing positive relationship from the chart, one wonders why the relative poverty norm increases in the course of development when countries are moving from low income position to relatively higher income position. Perhaps economic development that is generated in backward countries requires enormous social tension, which in turn gives rise to the need for generous assistance. And with social assistance to the disadvantaged and with economic incentives to those who are capable of participating in economic development, countries generate economic development to up to a certain level. And by that time, countries may have created the necessary institutional mechanism which would function smoothly afterward. And after the middle level of income, the established social mechanism would generate further economic development. And so among the developed countries, one may say that further steam toward higher incomes may be generated at the cost of the disadvantaged and the poor, who, after all, have very little to say on the total course of events. This section must have raised more questions than it has answered. The behavioral dimensions of international differences in welfare policies do not easily lead to neat generalizations, nor are there quantitative indicators which are sensitive enough to reflect these dimensions on infallible scales of more or less. One indicator proposed in this section, together with supporting observations, seems to indicate a broad outline of correlations between characteristics of socioeconomic systems and welfare efforts. Now I would like to proceed to examine the relationship between the level of relative poverty norm and the size of poverty. I now ask you to turn to table 2. On chart 1, we observed that the relative poverty norm is the lowest for the United States among the countries represented on the chart. If the assistant standard is low, it can ordinarily be expected that the size of poverty should be correspondingly low. But this evidently does not hold for the United States. Not only is the assistance standard low in the United States, but also there are a large number of poor whose incomes are even lower than the low assistance standard. The relative poverty norm for the United States on the per capita basis is 26% of gross national product per capita. And the people whose incomes are below this line amount to 18% of the U.S. population. Compare this with the United Kingdom to see the contrast. The United Kingdom had set a reasonably high assistance standard, amounting to 25% on a per capita basis. And yet, the proportion of the people whose incomes are below this level of income is relatively small, slightly less than 4% of the UK population. Even that little backward country, Japan, seems to do a little better than the affluent United States. Having adopted a somewhat ambitious social standard for assisting the poor, Japan has been capable of eliminating a large part of poverty, so that the proportion of people who remain with the incomes below the social assistance standard is lower in Japan than in the United States. The most successful country, measured by the size of poverty, is Australia. Australia has adopted a high social assistance standard and has also succeeded in virtually eliminating poverty by that standard. Only 2% of the Australian population is found to be remaining in the poverty category. Canada is also included in Table 2. And the Canadian social assistance standard, or rather the standard of income adopted for the Canadian war on poverty, is the same as the United States Social Security Administration standard, $3,000 for the family of four. However, I tend to feel, on the basis of the numbers presented in Table 2, that the uncritical acceptance of the $3,000 mark as a poverty norm for Canada exaggerates the extent of poverty in Canada. That level of poverty norm comes up to 41% on the per capita basis of the gross domestic product of Canada. And naturally, with this high level of assistance standard, Canada is seen to be stuck with a larger size of poverty, running to 23%. The nicest way of increasing the size of poverty is to set the standard high, so high as to be impossible for complying with. $2,000 mark seems to be much more reasonable for Canada. It is surely no cause for celebration that a country has more poverty than other countries. But the rhetoric of the war on poverty is such that one gets the impression that the warriors may actually prefer a large enemy, for the resolve and the gallantry are a rising function of the size of war. A year before the centennial of Canada, Benjamin Schlesinger proclaimed, I am now quoting a sentence from his work, "As the country approaches its birthday celebrations, the fact that nearly one quarter of the families live under the poverty line cannot be ignored in taking stock of all the accomplishments and successes which have made Canada a great nation." Schlesinger is using $3,000 for a family of four as the poverty norm. And he's surprised with the existence of a great extent of poverty in Canada by that standard. Japan is a rather realistic country. There is no war on poverty in Japan. The government is discreetly low-key with regard to welfare matters and always far behind the widespread wishes and sentiments of private citizens aspiring for a welfare state. The revision of the national assistance standard has long since been an annual affair, which involved three parties in bargaining, that is, the Ministry of Welfare, the Ministry of Finance, and the general public. At the time of the annual budget preparation, the Minister of Welfare announces how much the government can raise the national assistance standard in the following year. Organizations and the citizens then take issue with the minister about the adequacy of the announced revision. With the state of the public opinion in mind, the Minister of Welfare bargains with the Minister of Finance And the final figure, which is entered in the budget, is usually higher than what was previously announced by the welfare minister and lower than what the public demanded. The upward adjustments of the national assistance standard lagged behind the increase in national income during the 1950s. And that is Japan's gimmick of anti-poverty efforts, deliberately dragging the standard for assisting the poor behind what the economy is capable of achieving. In the end, the growing economy by itself would eliminate poverty. Japan's lower incidence of poverty than the United States, as shown in Table 2, raises a number of empirical and analytical questions in regard to income distribution. The Japanese government's welfare aspirations are decidedly lower than the United States government's. And the ratio of actual recipients of public assistance to the poor is lower in Japan than in the United States. However, public assistance in Japan raises the incomes of many of the recipients up to or beyond the Japanese poverty norm, while the recipients of public assistance in the United States mostly remain within the US poverty norm. This is because the Japanese poverty norm is the assistance standard itself, while most of the assistance standards in the United States are lower than the US poverty norm adopted by the Social Security Administration. Japan's welfare aspirations are lower and her welfare budget is more strained than the United States, but Japan's poverty is less extensive than the than the United States. This suggests that the income distribution by size prior to welfare payments may be more egalitarian in Japan than in the United States. Let me hasten to come to the conclusion of this paper. Some societies may be more prone than others to the possibility that welfare aspirations autonomously escalate regardless of the pattern of income distribution and economic feasibility. Aspirations are costless, although their implementation costs time and resources. Aspirations usually take the form of exhortations for a better performance by society as a whole, while economic feasibility is determined by how much each individual is willing to give for the good of society. The individual who demands a high standard of behavior for society is not necessarily the one who is willing to share the requisite cost. The size of poverty, as we have defined, represents an inconsistency between aspiration and performance, between minimum tolerable standard of living in principle and actual tolerance of substandard living in parts of society. This is also an inconsistency in perception as to what society should do and what he is actually willing to do. Quite naturally, this is a usual inconsistency that exists in relation to any public good. The benefit of a better society is shared by all, but each resists the share of burden for the improvement. Upon the counsel of self-interest, the individual tends to behave strategically, as pointed out by Paul Samuelson long ago, and would not reveal his true preferences in regard to the benefit of publicly provided goods. In the light of Table 2, the dilemma between aspiration and feasibility in welfare is most acute in the United States and Canada. And yet, in terms of economic resources, these are the most affluent countries. In matters of poverty and welfare, the socio-psychological tangle is more complex than a simple dichotomy of social good and private strategy. The demand for a decent community is often a close relative of hostility to the poor, who in a way are pulling down the community standard of living. The hatred and the contempt for substandard living conditions are also components of the drive for higher living standards on the part of those who are capable of pursuing their interests. The concern about the community standard is a means of self-discipline to sustain the moral strength in the lifelong struggle for never-ceasing improvements in living conditions. The gap between norm and practice in welfare policy, therefore, reflects in large part the difficulty of managing the complex mind of modern man. It is no accident that the welfare state in the United Kingdom was a product of wartime solidarity, guided by the basic common denominator of life for all classes of men, women, and children, namely national survival. But today, in peace and affluence, life continues with a maximum allowance for all the whims and the drives of modern man, guided in uncertain ways by the demonstration effect. This said, I now notice that my investigation into welfare and poverty within the scope of this paper has run full circle. Thank you.